From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, we join our correspondent on the Hill as the battle to reinstate unemployment benefits for millions of America's jobless gets underway in Washington.
It makes a difference to a mother who needs help feeding her kids while she's looking for work. It makes a difference to a father who needs help paying the rent while learning the skills to get a new and better job. And denying families that security is just plain cruel.
Freezing winds and frostbite warnings. America braces for a record-breaking nationwide Arctic blast. And we're in San Francisco to discover which gadgets and gizmos will dominate the U.S. tech market in 2014.
Your wearable smartwatch will detect that you've woken up, and then it'll send a message to your coffee maker, and your coffee maker will start brewing your cup of coffee.
That's coming up on FSN Reports, after a summary of our day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has used a state television address to urge residents and tribes in the besieged city of Fallujah to force out al-Qaeda militants who have taken control of the area. Mr. al-Maliki said if the insurgents are not expelled, the city, well known for battles between U.S.-led forces and insurgents in 2004, would face military action within days. Lorna Shattuck has more.
Hundreds of people have already fled Fallujah in the Sunni-dominated western province of Anbar. Along with most parts of the provincial capital, Ramadi, it was taken over by al-Qaeda fighters last week, and Iraqi forces are now preparing to recapture the city after already subjecting it to airstrikes and shelling. Both the US and Iran have offered military support, but not troops. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki is a Shiite, and his government has little support in Sunni-dominated Fallujah. The Sunnis accuse the government of ignoring their needs and marginalizing them politically. Iraqi officials accuse the Sunnis of involvement in terrorism.
U.S. President Barack Obama is facing an ongoing series of foreign policy challenges in the new year. The Syrian crisis is nearly 3 years old. The Israeli-Palestinian peace process is stalled, and Iraq may be about to devolve into civil war. Washington correspondent Priscilla Huff reports.
On the foreign policy front, U.S. President Barack Obama will be tested in 2014 as he has never been tested before. That's the assessment of one former top American diplomat writing in the Boston Globe newspaper. For starters, representatives from 30 countries are heading to Geneva later this month in hopes of brokering some sort of peace for Syria. That conflict has killed 130,000 and is being described by the United Nations as the most expensive humanitarian disaster in modern history, with 40% of Syrians displaced. On the heels of U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry saying that the battle against al-Qaeda in Fallujah and Ramadi is Iraq's battle to fight, a new report from one of Washington's leading think tanks has experts warning that Iraq is on the verge of civil war as ethnic and sectarian divisions deepen. At the same time, Secretary Kerry's efforts to forge peace between the Israelis and Palestinians after 66 years of conflict have gotten little traction. A long list for President Obama.
Large sections of North America are in the grip of unusually frigid weather, with more to come as an icy blast of Arctic air bears down from the north. Areas as far south as central Florida are being advised to prepare for dangerous cold. Temperatures in some areas are expected to hit record lows, generating potentially life-threatening conditions. Malcolm Brown reports.
America's National Weather Service is warning that the Arctic air mass is bearing down on the eastern two-thirds of the country. Even parts of the U.S. famously accustomed to icy winters are feeling the effects of the so-called polar vortex.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The banking giant J.P. Morgan Chase is likely to reach a deal this week that would see it pay $2 billion in fines for its involvement in the Bernie Madoff fraud case. Nick Harper has more from New York.
The settlement is just the latest in a series of fines for JP Morgan Chase. In the last 12 months alone, it's paid out $20 billion US to government investigators to resolve cases against the bank. This fine is likely to total $2 billion in criminal and civil settlements for the suspicion that JP Morgan ignored signs about Bernie Madoff's criminal activity. JP Morgan was Madoff's main bank for more than two decades. Some of the victims of the fraud scam would be in line for payouts 5 years after Madoff was arrested.
And a diplomatic spat between Japan and China has deepened, with a Japanese official claiming China risks becoming the, quote, Lord Voldemort of East Asia. The Harry Potter reference by Tokyo's ambassador to London comes amid ongoing tensions over islands in the East China Sea. Ollie Barrett has more from London.
Keiichi Hayashi says China has two paths available to it: to seek dialogue and abide by international law, or to play the role of Voldemort and cause an arms race and escalation of tensions in East Asia. The reference to the villain of the Harry Potter stories comes after China's ambassador to London last week himself compared modern Japan to Lord Voldemort and urged British support for Beijing's position against what he said was an increasingly militaristic government in Tokyo. But his Japanese counterpart, also writing in the Daily Telegraph, says China's made repeated attempts to change the status quo in the region by force or coercion, and that one recent incident involving a Chinese destroyer in the East China Sea might be regarded as an act of war.
And that's the latest feature story news. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. In its first day back in session in the new year, the US Senate debated the fate of the millions of Americans set to lose their emergency unemployment insurance in the coming months. 1.3 million people already saw their benefits expire in December after Congress failed to reach a deal to fund the program before leaving for vacation. Now, advocates for renewing the benefits face an uphill battle as conservatives in the House and Senate demand cuts to offset even a short-term extension. On Capitol Hill, Alice Olstein has more.
Members of Congress are making good on their promise to put support for the long-term unemployed first on the docket for 2014, with the Senate set to vote this week on renewing the emergency benefits for millions of Americans. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid urged his colleagues Monday to pass a three-month extension and blasted them for allowing the program to lapse last month, a decision he called unconscionable.
We have never had so many unemployed for such a long period of time. The long-term unemployment rate is twice as high as it was any other time we've allowed emergency unemployment benefits stand. It would be catastrophic for men and women, boys and girls, for this to happen.
Reid's home state of Nevada has one of the highest unemployment rates in the nation, about 9%. When you count those who are underemployed or who have given up looking for work, the rate tops 18%. But many conservative lawmakers in the House and Senate have come out against the $6.5 billion extension, while others say they want something in return, such as cuts to other social programs or a rollback of labor or environmental regulations. Kentucky Republican Rand Paul has told reporters the social safety net program provides a, quote, disincentive to work, something many lawmakers and experts dispute.
These programs don't get in the way of people looking for work. They assist people who are looking for work.
That's U.S. Secretary of Labor Thomas Perez speaking to reporters on a conference call. He said the monthly checks are barely enough to live on for most families, and recipients have to be actively looking for work in order to qualify. Perez described meetings he held over the holidays with people who already have or are about to lose what he called a critical lifeline.
They've been looking day in and day out for work. They've been searching for jobs. They are trying to feed their family. They're trying to stave off foreclosure. They are making judgments between food and medicine, judgments that no person in America or anywhere should have to make. But these are the situations that they find themselves in. They've gone from a situation where they were in a position of hardship in December to a situation that is now a catastrophe for them because they no longer have the critical lifeline that the Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program provided to them.
Perez said the unemployment program should at least support people through the average length of unemployment, currently 36 weeks. He also said it's often not a question of laziness or effort, as there are still nearly 3 unemployed people for every 1 open job in the country. The Senate's procedural vote Monday night kicks off a week of events designed to pressure members of Congress to support the bill. President Obama will host a group of unemployed Americans at the White House on Tuesday, and he also used his weekly address to call for the extension, saying it makes both ethical and economic sense.
We make this promise to one another because it makes a difference to a mother who needs help feeding her kids while she's looking for work. It makes a difference to a father who needs help paying the rent while learning the skills to get a new and better job. And denying families that security is just plain cruel. We're a better country than that. We don't abandon our fellow Americans when times get tough. We keep the faith with them until they start that new job. What's more, it actually slows down the economy for all of us. If folks can't pay their bills or buy the basics like food and clothes, local businesses take a hit and hire fewer workers. That's why the Independent Congressional Budget Office says that unless Congress restores this insurance, we'll feel a drag on our economic growth this year. And after our businesses created more than 2 million new jobs last year, that's a self-inflicted wound we don't need.
A final vote in the Senate is expected later this week, and its fate in the House is currently uncertain. Lawmakers are rushing to put this issue behind them and move on to crafting a spending bill, which must pass by January 15th to avoid another government shutdown. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
And as the U.S. Senate debated the fate of those Americans reliant on unemployment benefits, economists have been highlighting why failing to reinstate financial support for the jobless could be harming the economy. FSN's Daniel Renches discussed the possibility with economist Heidi Scheerholtz from the Economic Policy Institute in Washington.
The intuition on the reason that stopping these unemployment insurance benefits is bad for the economy is actually really straightforward. The long-term unemployed are people who have been existing on unemployment insurance benefits for at least 6 months. Those unemployment insurance benefits are not generous. They replace a maximum, if you're lucky, of half of your prior earnings. So these are people who have been existing for a very long time on much reduced income. So they are people who are almost, by definition, cash-strapped. So when they get those benefits, they're not hanging on to them. They're not going to be able to save those benefits. They are going to basically have no other choice but to just spend those benefits on necessities in their economy, in their local economy. And that is what the economy needs right now. When people spend money, that increases demand for goods and services. Who produces goods and services? Workers. So businesses have to ramp up hiring. That's what the economy needs right now. Though it's worth noting that this question about unemployment insurance benefits, right now we're not talking about making the economy better off. We're actually talking about we're in a sort of do no harm scenario. The fact that we've cut off these benefits is pulling economic activity out of the economy that was supporting the economy in 2013. So cutting them off didn't make things better. It actually made things worse, and reinstating them will just restore things to where they were in 2013. Making things worse right now in this sluggish economy is exactly what we do not want to do. So these benefits should definitely be reinstated, regardless of the morality of it. Doesn't matter. You could take the perspective of, I don't even care about the living standards of the long-term unemployed if all I care about is the state of the recovery in the economy. Extending long-term unemployment benefits is a good thing to do.
Let me take the contrarian arguments, probably voiced better than I, by others who would say this, that essentially, what has been happening for too long in Washington is that people have been supporting the unsupportable in many different ways in the economy. And now is the time to take a little bit of the pain. And on top of that, if you continue to incentivize the unemployed to stay in unemployed, then you won't really kickstart the economy. You're just papering over the cracks.
That is a very interesting question, and economists have studied this like crazy. The question of do unemployment insurance benefits actually do any good, or are they just giving people sort of a reason to take a vacation rather than search for work? So there's a lot of work on this, and in particular, people have done a lot of work on this in the aftermath of the Great Recession. So how have long-term unemployment insurance benefits affected people's incentive to take another job and incentive to look for work. So what these carefully done studies have found is that the unemployment insurance extensions in the aftermath of the Great Recession have actually increased unemployment duration for recipients a little bit. So that fact is actually true. It's increased unemployment durations a little bit, but here's the rub. It has, most of that effect has been for good reasons. Mostly that increase in unemployment duration is due to people not dropping out of the labor force because they just give up. So you actually have to actively be looking for work in order to receive benefits. So that incentivizes people to continue looking for work, even though job opportunities are so weak out there, because they know that if they continue actively seeking work, they're going to be able to get those benefits. So when you cut off those benefits, you're going to remove that incentive for looking for work, and people are going to drop out of the labor force. They're just going to give up, stop looking. That's bad for the economy, because that means that a smaller share of those long-term unemployed are ultimately going to find work.
Heidi Scherholtz from the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, talking to FSN's Daniel Renches. Millions of people across America are bracing themselves for record-breaking sub-zero conditions. Severe weather warnings have been issued countrywide, among them Minnesota and Wisconsin, where temperatures have already dropped as low as minus 50 Fahrenheit. More than 16,000 flights have been cancelled and power outages reported nationwide. The chaos has largely been pinned to something called the polar vortex, a term explained to me by Andrew Friedman from research organization Climate Central.
The polar vortex, really is a series of low-pressure systems that circle around the Arctic region during the wintertime, especially. This, you can consider it sort of like an Arctic jet stream, and it divides the cold air to the south from the really frigid Arctic air to the north. So when bits and pieces of the Arctic vortex break off, or when the vortex itself slows down, it can meander and elongate and cause these dips in the jet stream over North America, over Europe, over Asia, and allow some of that really, really frigid air to move southward for a time.
So in your expert opinion, do you think the headlines that we're seeing about, you know, record-breaking, plummeting temperatures, conditions never seen before in the United States, are going to be proven correct over the next 24 hours? What's your prediction?
It looks to me like we're going to set quite a few records, but most of the records that we're going to set are ones that haven't been seen since the early 1990s or the 1980s, depending where you are. This is not going to be an unprecedented event for the United States. This isn't the end of the world. This isn't the day after tomorrow freezing scenario, but it is noteworthy nonetheless.
Not the day after tomorrow, not the apocalypse, but these severe conditions do carry a health warning, certainly in terms of frostbite.
Yes, frostbite is probably the number one concern. There was a weather warning that the National Weather Service in Minneapolis issued that I'm not aware of ever being issued before, which was a wind chill warning that was issued with the headline of "This is a particularly dangerous situation, a life-threatening situation." When you get wind chills down to negative 60, negative 65 degrees Fahrenheit, I mean, that can cause frostbite almost instantaneously. If you're a motorist that's stranded alongside the road and your engine goes out, you know, you're in a life-threatening situation pretty quickly.
And almost inevitably, these
these conditions and the amount of news coverage given to them has opened up the debate on climate change again. And we have, in particular, some climate change deniers who are suggesting that these conditions, these bitterly cold, record-breaking lows, in some way disprove global warming. There's some confusion here, isn't there?
Yeah, there is confusion. I think that it's easy to make such claims when it's this cold. The global data does not show anything of the sort that would lend credence to such arguments. November was the globe's warmest November on record. We are likely to see that 2013 will rank in the top six or seven or so of the top 10 years globally in terms of warmest years. We're probably going to see December rank up there because of warm temperatures, comparatively warm temperatures in much of Eurasia and parts of the Arctic. It's actually warmer in Alaska right now than it is in much of the lower 48 states. So, you know, and also considering that this cold outbreak is going to last for such a short period of time, we've had much more impressive, much more severe events in the past. In 1979, for example, Chicago endured about 116 straight hours of below 0 degree temperatures. And that they're getting nothing like that this time. So there's all sorts of reasons why, you know, climate scientists look at this and they see an extreme weather event that may actually have some links to climate change and what's going on with the melting sea ice during the summer and fall in the Arctic, for example. But yeah, you know, it brings all sorts of arguments out of the woodwork, and it's, you know, it's a little bit challenging as a journalist and as scientists who are trying to communicate on what's going on in the bigger picture and over the longer term.
Andrew Friedman from climatecentral.org. Now, 2013 was a big year for innovation. Elon Musk took the wraps off plans for his Hyperloop, a futuristic tubular transporter that promises to whisk passengers from Los Angeles to San Francisco in 30 minutes. NASA said it would start using 3D printing in its space missions, and Apple brought in fingerprint scanning as user identification for its new iPhone 5S. On the consumer front, tablets got smaller and thinner, PlayStations got cheaper, and Google's Chromecast made old TVs smart. So, what will 2014 have in store for gadget fans? Our San Francisco correspondent Rebecca Bowring takes a look.
2014 will be a big year for wearable technology. We'll see a surge in the popularity of activity trackers, intelligent pedometers that monitor your body's movement, sleep and calories. San Francisco-based Misfit Wearables manufactures the Shine, an elegant aluminium disc about the size of a quarter coin. Business development lead Justin Butler says they aim to make the most wearable device on the market.
It looks like something someone might wear every day, but it actually provides a lot more benefits than just a standard piece of jewelry. So really combining those two things, the form with the functionality, we think will continue to make Shine stand out from the competition.
Next year, smartwatches will get smarter. And of course, keep your eyes peeled for Google Glass version 2.0. 2014 will also usher in increasing flexibility in terms of how we top up our battery power. We're using phones and tablets more and more for multitasking on the go, but their batteries often can't keep up. PowerMat has partnered with global coffee giant Starbucks to install wireless charging stations in Silicon Valley. When users place their enabled iPhones on cable-free surfaces, they automatically start charging.
You plug it in like that, you drop it on the mat, and it wirelessly charges.
Scott Eisenstein is Global Vice President of External Relations.
The ecosystem allows you to go to places where you would travel ordinarily throughout your day, places like Starbucks and like McDonald's and then Delta Airlines. You can just charge your phone by means of hotspots that are built directly into the infrastructure.
San Francisco-based company Nomad has invented ChargeCard, a flat, ultra-thin USB cable that fits in your wallet. Noah Denzel, CEO of Nomad, says they're capitalizing on the increasing ubiquity of USB ports as power supplies.
You see them on back of TVs and computers and such, but also in hotels and new buildings that are incorporating USB ports into the plugs themselves.
Next year, homes and cars will also get more connected. It's what analysts call the Internet of Things. We'll see more everyday appliances linked to our smartphones using small wireless sensors that communicate by low-energy Bluetooth. Sharon Vaknin is an editor at tech media website CNET.
We'll see an influx in home sensors and smart home technology that talks to each other. So, for example, you might have a sensor in your basement that detects that there is water flooding, and then you get a message on your smartphone. Your wearable smartwatch will detect that you've woken up, and then it'll send a message to your coffee maker, and your coffee maker will start brewing your cup of coffee.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Release.
And if intelligent coffee makers aren't futuristic enough for you, then what about space travel? Virgin Galactic's to start offering suborbital space flights next year. Rebecca Bowring, San Francisco.
Now, China and the UK have already worked together on major movie blockbusters, but now the countries are increasing links with a new co-production treaty. Following British Prime Minister David Cameron's trip to China in early December, culture ministers have agreed that the countries will work more closely on TV and film production. It comes as China's film industry grows at a rapid pace, already worth some $15 billion. Our UK correspondent Dan Whitehead brings us this report from London.
Pinewood Studios is known as the home of James Bond and Harry Potter. For decades, sets here have been used in iconic British movies. But now they're featuring in Chinese productions as well. Back in April, Pinewood signed a deal with one of China's leading global entertainment companies, Seven Stars Media Limited, to co-produce movies and TV shows.
We're looking to bring the expertise that we have, make that available to productions working in China or to British productions coming into China to film hopefully Chinese stories that appeal to Chinese audiences.
The CEO of Pinewood, Ivan Dunleavy, joined the British Prime Minister David Cameron on his major trade trip to China back in December. While there, the British government signed a new culture agreement with China and worked out a co-production treaty in the hope that China and the UK can follow on from the success of Skyfall, which was filmed in both London and Shanghai. The UK Minister for Culture and Creative Industries, Ed Vasey, told me the government hopes joint movie ventures will flourish.
The British will have the opportunity to understand modern Chinese culture much better. And hopefully our Chinese friends will also have the opportunity to understand what Britain is like today. And that's really our primary purpose. But obviously there is an opportunity for Chinese investment in the UK. As I say, we have a generous film tax regime in the UK. So people, Chinese producers who are thinking about where they might make a film outside of China should look to the UK.
And be in no doubt, there is lots of money to make. China's movie sector is already the second biggest in the world, and analysts predict it will become the world's biggest filmmaker within the next decade. The ambition for China and the UK to create blockbusters with worldwide success is huge. But Mr. Dunleavy from Pinewood says it's the rising popularity of going to the movies in China, which is a big driving force behind this deal.
If you think about the Chinese market for film, in China, there are 7 new cinemas being built every day of the week. It's a fantastic growth opportunity and it's hungry for content.
And the UK is happy to feed that appetite, whether it's British films heading east or Chinese movies being shot in the UK. Dan Whitehead, London.
And that's the Monday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of our programme by emailing us reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. You can also follow us on Twitter. We're there at Feature Story. Coming up on Tuesday, we look at California's push to attract entrepreneurs and investment from Latin America. That's Tuesday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.